This is edition 401. We start again at the one of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries humanity has ever faced, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight on the program, Dave Furlott with his take on it, clips that we'd intended to play last week, but we just never got around to them because 2 hours just blew by with all the people that wanted to join us and celebrate the 400th edition of this program. And so we'll get into some of those tonight, and Alfred Lemberg will walk us home. And in studio with me tonight, again, is Wayne St. John.
Good evening, Errol.
Good evening, Wayne. And
good evening, audience.
Have you had an interesting week ufologically?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I'd say yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Making some headway with getting my friend on tape.
Dave
about his stories.
Yes, yes.
And that's coming along. It's coming along.
And look forward to hearing that and the latest in your series of...
Yes, of stories that no one has ever heard.
No one has ever heard. The amazing...
We'll be hearing that at 10 o'clock, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right after the top of the hour news, the amazing stories, the amazing events that have gone on around David and his... Farmer, I guess he doesn't live down there south of Queen off Leslie anymore.
No, he doesn't. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and his saga is ongoing.
It is. Yes, it is ongoing.
Look forward to hearing some of that later on from Wayne. Some UFO news stories. North Delta, B.C. on July 1st, a single light cigar-shaped object was observed hovering for a couple of hours. It was first noticed at around 5 in the evening, and at 7:30 there appeared to be two or three objects in the sky moving in swift little motions, but really not going too far. The object was silver in color, and one observer thought that there may have been an antenna dangling below it. The acceleration that it came up with seemed to be the opposite of any traditional aircraft, the witness said. It seemed to be moving slowly at first and accelerating faster as it started to move. Incredible, says the witness. It then moved in an S type of pattern, going straight up. Would that be a zigzag, do you suppose?
I suppose.
Yeah. It first appeared in the eastern sky, then moved more to the south. The witness said there were planes to compare it to during the sighting, and what they saw was not an airplane. And in Belleville, Ontario, almost a week later, July 6th, at around midnight, witness saw a light, first thinking it to be a falling star or shooting star, but it didn't fade. Then the witness thought it a meteor, but it didn't fade either. Passing over the property where the witness lives, it just seemed like a flat disc, colored mottled amber or orange, as if the setting sun was illuminating it. Hmm. Good description, that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, mottled orange. A lot of sightings like that one. Mm-hmm. Mottled orange, and there was no sun, though. Hmm. Witness couldn't tell how high it was, so there's no estimation of its size. It traveled at a steady speed, no sound, on a north-to-south course. As it passed overhead, he lost sight of it behind a tree, so stood and turned as by now it had passed over and saw it again for a moment, and then lost visual contact completely, only to see it reappear slightly, and then it was gone.
Hmm.
Yeah, had George Filer's files posted that one, and the report came from Brian Veit. And in Vancouver, another familiar story, witness went on a smoke break on the rear alley entrance balcony, and their attention was immediately drawn to this metal rod floating in a very ominous manner, like a feather or balloon blowing in the wind. That was on July 5th, between 4 and 5 p.m. Witness could only comprehend this thing as a balloon until they noticed that it was very smooth and dark gray in color, reflecting the sunlight. He called for his boss to come out and witness this bizarre floating rod. The boss watched it silently for about 2 minutes, and to the witness's surprise, he was very startled. He then made a silly UFO joke and went back inside. This object seemed to be over the downtown area, and this is Vancouver we're talking about, as it traveled northwest over North Vancouver. Witness found it freaky, he said, because it seemed quite fast for a balloon in the shape of a metal rod to move in that way. It seemed to slow down, spiral upward, then slowly turned and banked in a very peculiar fashion. There were no creases, letters, or numbers, or anything at all on the exterior of this metal rod. It was simply a shiny metal-looking cylinder, the shape of a cigarette, and was very stiff and rigid. The witness said that the more he thought about it, he began to change his mind about it being a helium or gas-filled device, because the strong winds at that height probably would have caused the cylinder to warp in shape. It was a completely smooth metal rod that floated over the city, and that's that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And again, thanks to Filer's Files and Brian Veit up at HBCC UFO. And another one from BC, Fort St. John. Back on June 29th, a witness sitting out back waiting for it to get dark when this really bright white object appeared out of the northwest, heading southeast at a good clip. It seemed to be low enough not to be a satellite, so the witness started videoing it. Then looked down at the camera to change a setting, which was about 2 seconds. And, of course, when he looked back, the thing was gone.
It was gone.
Yeah. See, you blink and that's it.
Right.
We're still getting reports from around the world on triangles. This is in Florence, Italy, looking up at the sky from the roof on June 30th of a sixth-floor palazzo. They saw 7 lights that seemed like position light of a triangular object between 10:30 and 11 p.m. on June 30th. The lights moved slowly and silently in the night. After the witness concentrated on them, there were 7 different objects in that formation. They were elliptic and orange light-colored, like the city lights reflected by the clouds. The sky was clear. They flew all over Florence, Italy, from east to west, and later they turned to the north. Witness said they thought that they were flying just a little over a hill, which is about 400 to 500 meters high, and that they were probably about 20 meters across.
Hmm.
So, yes, and lots of flying triangles reported from all over the planet still. Disc shapes, cigar shapes, cigarette shapes.
Yeah, and on major highways, I understand, in the States, like Highway 5 that goes from on the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
from Canada right down to California, there's... reported sightings all the time, you know, these ships just hovering, and or not hovering, but they're actually gliding silently, too far from the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And a lot of reports from residents up and down that West Coast, too.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting things going on.
Is it ours or is it theirs?
Oh, yeah. Well, is it out of Area 51 or is it out of somewhere else?
Right.
Is it transdimensional? Is it time travelers coming, us coming back to have a look at ourselves?
Yeah. And many possibilities.
Many indeed, and unfortunately, we still don't know.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list that has been going on for a while now. And I've kept my comments and references to the subject matter very low-key. The subject matter is the extradition of British citizen Gary McKinnon to the United States to stand trial for hacking into government computers because he was searching for evidence of aliens, UFOs, and the ongoing cover-up concerning all of it. Now, the U.S. government claims that Mr. McKinnon has caused considerable damage to some vital government and military systems, and he should be held accountable for his actions and therefore be tried by the U.S. judicial system. This, of course, means that if found guilty of the crime, he could be serving decades in some U.S. federal penitentiary. Britain does have an extradition treaty with the U.S., so, well, they have agreed to turn Gary McKinnon over to them for prosecution. So if we are to examine everything legally, everything is above board. Somebody does something that is a crime against the United States. He's living in a country that has an agreement to ship people that do such things over there, and the U.S. have the right to prosecute such individuals for their crimes. Slam dunk, let's go home. But, yeah, I know you knew there was a but in there someplace. There's just one tiny little problem with all of this. With all of the international controversy caused by this, the question now becomes, how is it possible for Gary McKinnon to receive a fair and just trial for his actions? His name hasn't been out of the media circus for a single day. Oh, yeah, he may have gone from page one news to page 12, but he is still in the news in the U.S., Britain, Canada, and countless other countries out there that have been following this story, not to mention the millions of comments floating out there on the Internet. I challenge anyone out there that recognizes Gary McKinnon's name to not have already formed an opinion about his guilt or innocence. Oh, and according to the U.S. judicial system, a defendant has the right to receive a fair and speedy trial. But, well, in this situation, Gary McKinnon is now being referred to as a terrorist. And because of that little title, that means Gary could be held without trial for a very long time. It also means that he can be questioned without legal representation, and it also means that he could be just kind of slipped into a detention area like Guantanamo Bay and forgotten about. From the U.S. point of view, yeah, it is a slam dunk, and Gary is the ball. Now, let's examine some of the facts of this case. Gary managed to get into some rather sensitive computer systems because the users of the networked computers could not be bothered to create a password to sign on when they booted up their systems. Basically, it's like living in a very attractive mansion and not bothering to place any locks on the doors because it's too much of a pain in the butt to have to use a key to gain entrance to your home. Or leaving the key to your car in the ignition all the time because you don't want to have to carry it around. In either of those instances, if you were burglarized or your car was stolen, the police would tell you to call your insurance company and wouldn't even bother investigating. Your insurance company would probably tell you to get lost because, well, you should have placed locks on the doors and maybe it would have been a good idea not to leave the key in the car. Now, that's not the case, however, with poor Gary. What I'd like to know is what is happening to the computer users that left the doors open so people like Gary could get in? Matter of fact, and if I was defending Gary, I'd say that he was simply surfing. And he came across these computer systems, and, well, when he figured out what they were, he simply disconnected. And he had no idea that he was causing any damage. But then, that assumes that Gary will get a trial? Yeah, silly me. From a ufology point of view, the Gary McKinnon story is going to become legend. The theories are going to be many. Things like, well, he found something and they had to silence him. Or, well, he actually didn't find anything and he just was viciously lashing out, destroying government data. Or, all of the things he did discover were deleted by the government or military as part of the cover-up, and they're using Gary as a scapegoat, and they're blaming him for their deletion and the exorbitant costs associated with the loss. You know, the question in the whole Gary McKinnon story is not whether he is innocent or guilty. It's not whether he found anything or not, and it's not even whether he did any damage. The question is, how long will the legend of Gary McKinnon last? But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Yes, Gary McKinnon, the saga's all over the place tonight, but that continues. He only got to see one image, he said.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that was, he was using a dial-up, a very slow machine, a very slow connection. And as the image started to scroll down his screen, you know the way it does, build from the top mm-hmm. to the bottom?
Yeah.
It was of some sort of object in orbit, he felt, around the planet.
Yeah.
And the object had little domes on the top and the bottom.
It's going to be one of those things. This is going to... We'll be talking about this 50 years from now.
Yeah, on program 2074 or whatever. Yeah. He supposedly caused $3,500 worth of damage to each computer that on the system. I mean, it's something totally
ludicrous.
And it's not so much the users of the computer systems, it's the IT guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know, who sit at the top of that pyramid.
Oh, yeah. First off, you've got the users who didn't bother to put in the password, and then you've got the IT guys who let them get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, bad, bad, bad.
Yes, fairly stupid, I think is the expression. And
yeah.
If it had been pre-9/11, he would have gotten a slap on the wrist. And
oh, yeah.
In the terrorista post-9/11, then they're going to send him to Gitmo.
Yep.
And forget about it.
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be sitting down there going, really, I didn't mean to.
Yes. Dave, I have to say thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Okay. I want to take you back. Where were you in 1972, Wayne St. John?
In 1972, let's see, I think I might have been... With a group called St. John, right? It was
right Hair. After Hair.
After Hair was Hair After, and then I had a recording, which surprisingly has done amazingly well. Somebody saw it on eBay, a single copy for $400.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
45.
Were you in Toronto at that time?
Yes, I was.
An interesting story. August 15th, 1972, and Don Ledger had asked me a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
our East Coast correspondent, if I would tell people about this one and see if anybody recalled the incident. This was originally reported in 1988 to Peter Davenport at the National UFO Reporting Center. And it ended up being posted on the New Fork website in 2003. Location is Toronto, Forest Hill. Two young females witnessed a glowing sphere land in the middle of an urban area and had confirmation from authorities. Summer of 1972 here in Toronto, as I said, in Forest Hill, the reporting witness told Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center that on a summer visit to her grandmother's house, here, she and her best friend, teenagers at the time, noted that the dark kitchen was lit up like daylight at 1 o'clock in the morning. But it was a strange orange light, so the kids running to the window saw an enormous orange sphere, more than 6 stories tall, landing in an open ravine beyond the local business district, which was visible from the window that they were looking from. They watched for some time as the craft settled slowly into the clearing beyond apartment buildings two blocks away. No sound, but so bright it lit up the whole neighborhood. When this object landed, they could still see the top of it over the apartment blocks, hence the estimation of more than six stories tall when it landed. They had no fear and wanted to rush right down there and see it up close, but her grandmother and aunt woke up in the noise and kerfuffle the two girls were making and forbade them to go. Grandmother, a retired schoolteacher, and aunt, a CBC television costume designer, saw the craft as well and called the girl's parents in California to get her dad to prevent the girls from rushing out of the house. And Dad apparently remembers that call from Toronto. The girl's aunt suggested she call the police, and when the police operator answered, the little girl suddenly lost her voice and didn't know what to say, stammered, and the police operator said, "Are you calling from Forest Hill?" She said she was. "You calling about the flying saucer?" She said she was. "Can you see it now?" She said she could. "Can you see the high-rises from where you are?" She said she could. She then said, "Everyone in those high-rises has already called us." She went on to tell the girl that they were telling people to stay in their houses and the patrol cars were in the area to investigate. This is Toronto, folks, 1972. They watched for more than another hour, the craft still visible and on the ground behind the high-rise buildings. Eventually, the aunt made them go to bed. So they lay on the floor and listened to an all-night talk radio station, and all the calls were about the sighting. Eventually, they fell asleep on the floor in front of the radio, waking at daybreak, at which point they ran down to the area and found no signs of anything. No flattened grass, singed ground, nothing. They tried to call the talk radio station and got told that they were taking no more calls about flying saucers. Toronto is a busy city and there's lots more important stuff going on, they were told. There was nothing in either newspaper, Telegram or Star, and they called both newsrooms, only to be told that reputable papers didn't bother with silly nonsense like flying saucers. They called the police and were told that the night before there were some reports of some sort of prank in the Forest Hill Village area, but that investigating officers had found no signs of anything out of the ordinary. Really? The sphere was perfectly round, noiseless, and glowed with an amazing shade of pure, clear, orange light that entirely lit up the neighborhood bright as day. It took about 20 minutes to land gently in the field beyond the apartment buildings. The field is still there 20 years later between Spadina and Bathurst, and this took place just beyond the intersection of Lonsdale and Spadina in the middle of Forest Hill. After it landed, they could still see the top of it over the buildings between it and them with no movement and no sound. And after a couple of hours, they were almost bored and frustrated that they weren't being allowed out of the house for a closer look. Now, the police operator told her that everyone in those high-rises, also visible to them, had called them, and the operator seemed to be caught up in it at the moment, and the witness considers the police operator to have verified this sighting to her. She filed reports of this sighting with a few other researchers and groups over the years because she still can't believe that she's the only witness around who remembers it. It must have been seen by many people. The police operator told her that the lines were ringing off the hook. And remember, in 72, they didn't have caller ID, even at the police station. The emergency operator asked her if she was in Forest Hill. Today, the witness is a 41-year-old mother of a teenager working as a station manager of a local cable company community access television channel in British Columbia's Gulf Islands. She's college-educated, doesn't drink or smoke. She knows what she saw, remembers the entire incident vividly. Her aunt and grandmother, who saw the thing with her, are dead now, but her father is alive and remembers the telephone call from her aunt. When her friend, who is traceable, and she were so intent on going outside to get a closer look at the object. Now, if you're hearing this program and remember that August 1972 night in Forest Hill here in Toronto, we'd like to hear from you. Did you witness the same object? Do you remember talking or hearing about it? Let us know, not on air, not on the radio, but if you'd care to give us a call and leave your number with Julian out in Master, an investigator will call you back in the next few days. We want to know more about this incident, if that's possible. 416-872-1010 is the number to call. That's 416-872-1010 or Star Talk. Or if you recall this incident and you're living out of town, 1-800-561-CFRB. That's right, isn't it, Julian? Yeah, it is. I haven't said it for a while, so it's, yeah. yeah. Okay, one little more snippet here before we play you a couple of clips. So we'll break and then come back and do some of those clips that we wanted to play last week. As many of you will know, this weekend is the 37th Annual International MUFON Symposium in Denver, Colorado. And John Schussler, who's been the international director and was instrumental in creation of the UFO investigating group since its founding 37 years ago, stunned the audience last night as he announced that he was leaving his post at the end of the year. He told the group that he'll remain on the board of directors. So that's the original director gone, and John Schussler gone at the end of this year. I guess it's a sign of the times at MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. Okay, let us break. We shall return and play you a couple of interesting, including the CIA reconnaissance pilot, Wendy Connors' clip from program number 400 last week. Several requests to hear that one again. People want to listen a little more carefully. Email us, SDI@virtuallystrange.net, as Monsieur Pelletier has done. He says he's often spoken to, he's spoken to Stan Friedman several times on the phone, ordering articles and books from him, and emailed him, and he's emailed me back. And by the way, I really like Wayne St. John's new song and Lemberg's music. Yeah, nice one. It's really great stuff. You should play more of it.
That's nice.
UFO related music maybe. You gonna write some UFO songs?
Yeah.
No, I think you should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as it is, One Love for the Planet is very sort of futuristic in its take on what we should be doing anyway.
Yeah.
So it's something to come up to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and we'll hear a little taste of that a little later on. A couple of years back, we had Professor Don Deary on the program, and, well, let me set it up the way it was set up 2 years ago. Ufology has more friends in the halls of academia than it does sometimes seem to be aware of. And a splendid example is our featured guest tonight, Dr. Don Deary, who's Associate Professor of Psychology at McGill University in Montreal. Now, his credentials include Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science degrees from the University of Chicago in the late 50s, and a PhD in Experimental Psychology from Cornell University in 1963. Dr. Don Deary has over 40 years' experience in human factors, ergonomics, and applied experimental psychology. He's the co-author of a psychology textbook, many research papers and technical reports on human perception, motivation, memory, and thinking. And Dr. Don Deary has also written many articles for UFO-related publications and contributed a chapter titled Science, Law, and War, Alternative Frameworks for the UFO Evidence in UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge, an academically based book edited by Dr. David Jacobs and published by Kansas University Press. My mind actually boggles a little bit when I think of a man with all of your credentials who has quite openly said, this subject, unidentified flying objects, is fascinating to me. And the amount of time and the amount of energy and the amount of work that you've put into this field, aside from all of the other work that you do, what intrigued you with all of this?
Well, I'm a curious person, curious about the way things are. And I've been curious about the way things are for a long time. This goes back during my undergraduate years when I first heard about UFO sightings on the radio, literally, And I figured at that point I'd find out a little more about things myself, so I joined NICAP, the original National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, active during the 60s, and began to get involved, literally, in something that matched my professional qualifications, because I'm a researcher in perception and memory. And these things are obviously phenomena that people see and then remember and tell you about.
In the past, we have spent a lot of time scratching our heads on this program, wondering why it is that science appears not to be interested in this phenomena at all.
It's a very interesting and, I think, fairly clear answer to this. Scientists are people, not in the past, but currently, I'd say the last 50 years, are people driven by theoretical interest and by what Thomas Kuhn, who wrote about the philosophy of science and the practice of science, called paradigms. That is, little pictures of the way the universe should work that they try to fill out. And in Kuhn's word, they are trying to solve very complicated crossword puzzles where they know the techniques, they have the dictionary, and basically all it takes is a lot of application, specialized skills, and hard work to get to where you're going. And if anything comes up that's outside your own area, it's not grist for your mill, because it doesn't fit what you're doing and it doesn't fit the limits of your vision as a scientist. And almost every scientist has a very limited vision of what his or her work is. Let me cite you something that David Jacobs quoted from Albert Einstein years ago. Einstein said, apropos of UFOs, "These people have seen something. What it is, I do not know and do not care, or do not want to know." In other words, Einstein, probably the greatest scientist of the 20th century, one of those imaginative scientists of the 20th century who contributed all sorts of new ideas to physics, had no interest in this phenomenon, which he didn't deny was a phenomenon. And scientists are like that. They work in paradigms. They work in their area of interest. If it isn't something they can use to explain or elaborate a new theory, or if it isn't something that changes a present theory into one that is better in their field, it's just, in Kuhn's words, it's not evidence. It's not something a scientist has any business, as a scientist, paying any attention to. So scientists are perfectly qualified to dismiss and ignore everything that's outside of their, and I say this with respect, narrow technical field of interest. There are very few scientists whose business, like mine, is to study human perception and memory, who would even take a semi-professional interest in this field because it just doesn't fit into what they're having to do.
Yes, science isn't always what science does, is largely what that boils down to. There was an interesting scientist who worked in the radio field back in the 50s, Wilbert Brockhaus Smith, ran a flying saucer club at his house. People came from all over North America to come to these soirees that he has had. James Smith, his son, was on this program 2 or 3 years ago, and here's what he had to say about those flying saucer club meetings in Ottawa.
At our home, when this flying saucer club met in the basement, there were basement windows, and on many occasions there would be small monitor saucers looking in the window and here listening to what was going on. In terms of size, they'd be, well, 30, 36 inches across and about a foot thick, rather looking like a jelly donut. I came out of the front porch one evening, it would be just after dark, and came down the front steps, and there was one sitting about 3 feet off the front lawn where he could look in the window and monitor what was going on. And we sort of stood there and looked at each other for 20 or 30 seconds or so, and then it just took off straight up. The grass underneath it was virtually completely sterile for the next 10 years. Nothing would grow. There was this great patch of nothing. Similarly, in the trees at the back of the house, again, with access to a window, our neighbors used to complain, "Smith, keep your saucers in your old trees, because these things would sit up there and virtually burn all of the leaves and branches around them. There'd be this great dead clump, dead hole in the middle of two or three trees that had access to the windows."
Yeah, flying saucer club meetings at Wilbert Brockhaus Smith's house in Ottawa back in the 1950s. Department of Communications radio engineer responsible for radio stations all over Ontario, including this one, was Wib Smith. I like that. That's Wayne St. John, "One Love for the Planet."
Indeed.
This man has been around the scene here. Listen to that pan pipe. Bring it up, isn't it? Pan flute.
is. Brought it with me tonight.
That's a very tough-looking instrument. I mean, it's substantial, solid is what it is. It looks like something that came off a UFO somewhere.
Indeed so.
Very nice, very tasty, good music. Wayne has been around the scene here in Toronto, was an original Hair cast member, does still many, many, many things in the business here, choirs, and you were playing at the Distillery District this afternoon?
Yes, I was today.
Drumming today. Multi-talented man. Also been into UFOs and the phenomena around it for many years, too. Yes?
Yeah. Since I was in Hair 37 years, it's been that long. It's
really?
A good time to remember, you know, how it all started. It started with a poltergeist in my house. Yeah, out in West Hill in a farmhouse. And that consequently led to UFOs. It was a sort of a direct switch to one of the meanings for poltergeist effect is supposedly when a ship, a UFO, would leave suddenly, it leaves a wake.
Uh-huh.
And in this wake, they call it the poltergeist effect.
Really?
So it's just one of the... Yeah.
I've not heard that before. I mean, of course, I've heard of poltergeists and the strangeness that happens. Interesting, lately I've been reading on various websites about the poltergeist-like effects that happen after there are sightings. It's sort of bizarre, sort of ghostly things.
Yes.
And wanted to get into that with Sue Derrick and Matthew Didier the next time they're on the program, because that, too, is interesting. And back around that time that you were involved with Hair, I was involved with the Toronto Peace Festival.
Oh.
Running John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Peace Station Network, which was part of that whole scene.
That's right, in fact.
And there were people coming up to Toronto saying, the Martians are coming in these enormous spaceships and they'll be at the Toronto Peace Festival. Very, very strange. It got too strange for even John and Yoko, and they pulled out.
Right.
And
then
wrote a song called Instant Karma. The company that was putting on the Peace Festival was Karma Productions.
Right.
And that's where that song came from.
And during Hair, that was when they were there, when they pulled out of that Peace Festival, there was a song written called Get Back John, which Brenda Russell, the famous Brenda Russell now, who was Brenda Gordon then, was involved with that, Terry Black, Laurel Ward, and myself, and we put this record together.
You wanted John Lennon to come back and do the
so it was Get Back John thing, and they had the signs out in front of Sam's, and they're...
Strange days.
Yes, indeed.
It's amazing how things tend to revolve around one another in this business, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a small world.
After all. Indeed.
Yeah.
So, let's go back. This is what now, the third installment of the story of David.
Fourth, really.
Yeah. Time flies.
It does. It's amazing. It does.
We established that David lived on a street south of Queen and just off Leslie in a little park there, close next to a park there.
Right. Actually, what it was, he lived right on Queen, 1253 Queen Street East, and that was pretty near the Duke Hotel. So that on the south side, his back of his building, which then had a porch pretty high up, he could see the whole park, a whole view of the park, and also see the lake from that vantage point.
Which a little tiny
now.
Park, though, right?
Very tiny.
Parklet, in fact.
Yeah, parkette.
Yeah,
for
parklet.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Alexander Graham Muir's Maple Leaf Forever Park is what it is,
Yeah. So, and he had many close encounters of the fourth kind when he lived in that neighborhood.
He did. One of the fascinating stories that he told, again, I, you know, when I heard it, I thought, now he can't make this up. He just couldn't. It had to do with visualization and him actually learning visualization at a young age of about, I guess he was about 9.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, to me, visualization today is a sort of a futuristic concept because so many people are stuck in the matrix of, you know, their daily life and work and jobs and everything. And if one would step outside that and look at some of the things that could possibly be valid in the future, regarding visualization, it could help all of us, really. And I'll give you an example. Raymond Grace, who has a website, he's a shaman. He's been taught by some wonderful, brilliant people over his career. Raymond came up with, for instance, a visualization to purify water, a glass of water, a jug of water, whatever, you know. And we're talking tap water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of our tap water has fluoride in it, and I don't know if our folks out there listening now know that in England, for instance, fluoride has now been banned, which that's something to think about, because the fluoride actually is a very harmful thing to be putting in our bodies, even at minute amounts. And I've seen our water in bottled water anywhere from 1 point part per million to 30 parts per million. And so I go around looking at all the water, and the best one I've seen right now, the way they produce it and put it together, is the President's Choice spring water.
So there goes the cash registers. And Couch's eyes are rolling back and up.
Well, you know, people should really take a look at this, you know. For instance, Raymond Grace
so
says...
What does visualization have to do with UFOs and David's experience?
A lot.
And when you say visualization, what exactly does that mean?
Okay, I'm going to give you an example, and I'll get to David. What I wanted to bring to people's attention, and they can go and search this on the net themselves, that Raymond Grace came up with six words to purify water. Your drinking water, your glass of water, you look into the water, you hold it, you think about it, whatever you want to do. You could be in the next room and you think about it. And basically, it's the six words are scramble the frequency of the pollutants. And when you think that thought and you put it into the water, it actually does have a chemical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Scramble the frequency of the pollutants. And so that visualization, you can carry that on to looking at a lake. Go out and stare at a lake and say, I scramble the frequency of the pollutants in this lake. And it goes on and goes on. Now, again, get back to some of our treated water. Raymond Gray says that it's very difficult to do anything with your mind. He has purified large bodies of water. A river here in Toronto, actually, about 2 years ago, he basically, from a distance, did his prayer and his visualization of one of our rivers in Toronto. And the following spring, the river went from dark, scuzzy, no plant life to a pristine, clear river with growing lily pads, etc. This is the true story. And so when you think of visualization like that, you question yourself, how is it possible? Can it be? But it is a futuristic way to think, to continue to purify things in your mind, having to do with what you put in your body.
Yeah. Talking about visualization, I do a thing if I need a new computer, I need a computer part or whatever, and Lord knows there ain't a lot of money in my life, and I just put it out there, and somehow it just always shows up.
Sure.
Yeah, well, what I need now is a Vespa motor scooter, okay?
Hey, keep that picture.
So I have that picture there, and...
People could
it'll arrive just in time for the first snowfall.
Yeah.
You mark my words.
Right. And people can try also when they park, go to park their car, they're going to go and from point A to point B, they can say, you know, ordering my parking spot. Right where they want to go,
yes.
And it happens.
But don't say any more about it because it cuts the odds down. With all those people out there doing it. So visualization.
Yes.
Okay, so the David story,
so
it ties in.
Yes. This happened in back of David's house one day. He was... His dad was pitching a baseball to him. It was a hard ball, and he was young, and he was pitching it rather hard. And out of the wooded area where some of the extraterrestrials have been known to appear and come out of the grove of trees, a woman came over who both of them were familiar with, and she was observing this ball being pitched to David very hard. And she interrupted and said to the dad, let me take over. Let me try something. I want to show you something.
Mm-hmm.
She said, do you have a game today? And he said, yes, tonight I have a game. She says, okay, well, I'm going to give you some visualization pictures, and I'm going to basically get you in a state right now where you will absorb every word I'm saying, and you will follow through when you're pitching. You're the pitcher of this game and tonight, and you are going to pitch a perfect game. And so she then took the ball and was throwing it at Dave, and not as strong and maybe sort of awkward a bit, but she really wanted to, perhaps another bit of intervention, take the ball out of the dad's hand because it was whipping. He was whipping it pretty hard at the kid. So that evening, the game took place, and there David was pitching a most perfect game all the way through until the last inning, one of his teammates dropped the ball. But otherwise, he had pitched a perfect game. And nobody could believe it. I mean, all of his friends and family, they still talk about that because it's come up recently.
Huh.
So there he was. He
40 years later.
Yeah, huh? Exactly. And the proof of that something really did happen with him between him and her, with her giving him the visualizations, was that the next few games where he was the pitcher, it didn't work.
Huh.
He didn't pitch a great game at all. It was almost the opposite. It was as if he was just struggling and flailing away. It was not a picture perfect game.
The thing that puzzles me about these beings and David is why their interest in him. Have you figured that out? Has David told you anything about that?
Well, there's a lot of things that I really can't say right now, but I can give you some hints. I can say that in certain contactees there is bloodline.
Cross-generational.
Cross-generational, and it does look very possible that this is part of it.
Uh-huh.
It also looks very possible that his incarnation, one of his incarnations, belongs to these people. In other words, they're one of their loved ones. Let's say when he was born, he had an incarnation that was one of their loved ones that joined him in his growth process.
Yeah, and this, and again, we go wandering off into other fields, if you like. That's the word I prefer to use. You go into other fields where a lot of us believe that the paranormal, UFOs, many things that we consider paranormal are all interconnected, including UFOs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, the lines begin to blur the more time goes by for you and I and for many other people, but there are still those out there who like to wear those ufological blinkers, you know, and then not interested in what's flying the things.
Right.
All they're interested is the things themselves.
Yeah.
They don't care where they come from. I mean, it's too strange for me sometimes.
You know, I believe that there's an international reverence that's happening here with the extraterrestrials that will be eventually showing themselves very soon. Hang on, folks.
Yeah, we're waiting. We're waiting.
Yeah, I'm waiting too.
Yeah, it better be soon. I'm getting older. It's a musical night tonight on News Talk 1010 CFRB's Strange Days Indeed. Alfred Lemberg writes a lot of the music that he plays, as he is doing here, after seeing things sitting on his stoop down there in Alabama, looking at the sky in the early hours of the day. This piece is called Crawling Sky. And if you close your eyes, even with AM, if you close your eyes, you can visualize, which is what Wayne St. John was saying just before the news. And you can see the thing flying through the air. Yes, Alfred Lemberg joins us on the line. This is his theme music, Crawling Sky, from down there in Alabama. Good evening, Alfred Lemberg.
And a good evening to you, Errol, and a good evening to you, Mr. St. John. I like the way you think, sir.
He left. Yeah, he'd been drumming up a storm down at in the distillery district this afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And, you know,
a little whacked out, huh?
Yeah, you know how energetic drummers can be, and Wayne is no exception. So he begged forgiveness, and as we speak, driving out of the parking lot downstairs and listening to us as he heads for home.
That's almost as good as it gets.
It couldn't get much better. Did you hear the Wendy Connors clip last week of the CIA reconnaissance pilots?
And you said you were going to play that again tonight.
Yeah. There were several clips that I wanted to play tonight. And once again, you know, it's that two-hour crunch that we get into on Saturday nights here. And
there's a lot to talk about, and there's a lot going on, and it's all pretty startling, and between each segment, you kind of have to take your breath and quasi-absorb it somehow.
Yeah,
you know?
Somehow. A lot of people actually emailed me and said, what was that you played? I missed the start of it. So let's set this up. This is a clip that Wendy Connors sent us for the 400th program last week. Those of you who missed it missed a lot of people last Saturday night, including Wendy Connors, who made a very brief appearance with us because she's still not feeling 100%, and we're really grateful that she did. But this clip came from the National UFO Reporting Center back in 1977, and a CIA reconnaissance pilot couldn't think of anybody to report his UFO sighting to other than Robert Gribble at the National UFO Reporting Center. So having said that, here is said CIA reconnaissance pilot talking to Robert Gribble.
I fly for the CIA. I'm a reconnaissance pilot. I just came from Tokyo. I just landed about 10 minutes ago at the flight level 510. Now, I was out of radar contact, just on my own alone there, but I was still in radio contact, and this thing came up to me. No wings, about double the length of my airplane. I was flying a Phantom F-411. No bottom and no top, all equidistant sides of the triangle. And they weren't sharp. They were sort of rounded off edges. No noise, no wings, no thrust, no windows, nothing which would give it reason to fly. It was there. It wasn't my imagination. It was a porous material, probably. Well, it looked like sponge rubber, so it looked fine. But it was not metallic. The closest it got was about 70 feet from the wings. Now, I have radar, and it was on radar. It stayed there for about a half an hour. This is at Mach 2.2. The dimensions of the height, I'd say, were 10 feet by 10 feet. Two radar ships, but they were both out of range. And oddly enough, he disappeared right when this guy said, well, you'll be in range in about 3 minutes. And about a minute after that, this guy pulled away. I was curious. I climbed it to 60,000 feet. Well, that plane can climb very fast. It's one of the best planes we have. Like its actual top speed is classified. But anyway, I gave it full power and put the nose up to 60,000 feet, and this thing kept up with no strain at all. It kept right next to me. And he started to move almost instantly when I did, like he knew I was going to do that. I went up 60,000 feet and sort of stayed there for a little while and put into a dive to see if I could outrun him. He stayed right up with me with no problem at all. And then the guy said, well, you'll be within radar range in about 3 or 4 minutes. And about a minute after that, he pulled away from me, going forward, at least triple the speed, with no effort at all. I mean, no acceleration. He just was there, then he was a speck, and then he was gone. My commanding officer's name is Admiral, and he's Chief of Naval Intelligence at the Pentagon. The people at Approach Control and the Navy, they didn't seem to care. Either it's one of ours or it's somewhere else. But like I said, there's no reason for it to fly. It has no energy coming out of it, no heat, no power source, nothing.
Yes, 1977 had the poor CIA reconnaissance pilot. Nobody would take his reports, so he reported it to the National UFO Reporting Center. I still find that really, really strange. In 1977, we're talking flying triangle here, flying alongside and besting the best speed that the top aircraft of its time 30 years ago could muster. How about those goodies, Alfred Lemberg? You commented on it last week, didn't you?
The point point is that he comes back and complains about not being able to get his report to anyone because no one is interested.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point is there is that they're very interested, and they know it's the truth, but they can't stand to hear it because the moment they hear it and it's accepted, their whole world starts to come apart.
Exactly.
And I think wrongly so. I think that if the world comes apart on information like that, then, well, perhaps it should have come apart anyway. And I don't think that we are going to come apart in any case. I mean, I don't think it can hardly compare with dealing with glaciers that are encroaching from the north, you know, that has happened periodically. Mm. You know, we human beings are resilient. We have the stick-to-itiveness. We can get the job done. We can accept all sorts of things. And profit from them.
Mm.
And I think there's a lot of profit to be gained on the other side of UFOs with regard to energy and propulsion and philosophy and just, you know, like kicking us right out of the box where we probably belong, I should think.
Mm. So your perception is that the world wouldn't be turned on its tail were governments to come out and say, yes, there are visitors, and we have known about it for many, many, many years.
Yes, it probably would be turned on its tail, but that's a visit to the dentist's office that is not going to get any better with age.
Yes. Yeah. You see, there are a lot of people who are very bright, interesting, observant, clever people who really do feel that it would be a disaster if government were to admit that they know that we are being visited from somewhere or other.
The truth is better, Errol. It's longer lasting, it's got more solidity, it's got more validity, it's got more idiosyncratic credit. The truth is just better.
Well, if one takes into account what it is that abductees tell us, then it's not so pretty.
Well, you know, that's probably dependent a whole lot on the outlook, given the three takes on the subject by Hopkins, Jacobs, and Mack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had some pretty divergent attitudes about what was going on, and it may be just outlook, point of view, the concrescence approaches, the concrescence looms. They're happening pretty quick. You know, in fact, Mr. St. John alluded to it tonight that, oh, I hear the music.
So yeah.
Just that there's much going on. Who can say more than that?
Well, yes, and all of it going on at the same time, parallel. All around us, there seems to be a speeding up of things. And there seems to be. The sorting out is happening at the moment.
That's what all the scientists are saying. There is a definite speeding up of things.
Yeah, they're sorting the wheat from the chaff, the useful from the not so useful. If you were listening earlier tonight and you heard that story about the sighting in 1972 in Forest Hill around Lonsdale Road, and you recall that story and you don't want to phone, then email us, sbi@virtuallystrange.net. We'd like to hear about your experiences around that in August 1972 in Forest Hill here in Toronto. That voice in the background is Alfred Lemberg, our correspondent, biweekly calls correspondent Alfred Lemberg is on the line with us. So you said there were several things that needed to be talked about tonight, Alfred.
Did I?
Yes, you did.
Did I? Oh, I'm out of control.
Oh, no.
With regard to the sightings at Forest Hill, was it?
Forest Hill, yes.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. These things are six stories tall, seen by hundreds of witnesses.
And reported to the police. And, in fact, everybody who lived in those apartment buildings called the police and reported it. And then the next day, the police changed their story.
Well, there seems to be an awful lot of that going around.
Undoubtedly, yes.
Yeah, with regard to Mr. Furlotte's take this evening, very inspiring, and I could detect the concern and worry of some kind of activity south of his border that causes him, shall we say, some concern.
The Gary McKinnon UFO hacker case, yes.
Yes, indeed.
He's
yes,
being
indeed.
Extradited to the United States.
Yeah. You know, I think I've made it clear in any writing that I've done about him is I'm really only interested in a punishment fitting a crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the only thing driving me. I don't know as I buy into everything that Mr. McKinnon was involved with. I don't know as I believe his story. I don't know as he might be pointing at some things that were really peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
What I do know is that he did us all a service pointing up the rank incompetency that was going on there, the dereliction of duty, the complete and utter stupidity and dumbness of something that we thought was pretty much tied up in a productive, efficacious manner,
mm-hmm.
and that we are not being served like we thought we were being served. And for that, that young man should get a medal. You know, interesting enough, too, I have to tell you real quick before we run out of time again, is that Mr. McKinnon is a pretty accomplished musician. Did you ever go over there and listen to those two things that you can find on the web that he has done?
No, I wasn't aware that he was a musician, Alfred.
Yes, he is, and very much accomplished.
Mm.
And, oh, on the subject of musicianship, I have to defer entirely to real musicians that you heard this evening, and I am a rank amateur, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not holding that up as in any way comparable. Stingin is the musician.
Yeah, well, yes, he is. A multifaceted man, a Renaissance man, one might almost say.
I bang on a guitar and I don't know what the chords are.
Yeah, but you do sound like Sandy Bull, I have to tell you.
Well, I appreciate that, man.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on, with regard to Mr. Stingin, I indicated that I like the way he thinks. And though he did wander far afield this evening, he did come up with some interesting concepts, things that bear a little exploration. His idea,
yes,
confirmed by you, actually, that when you think something, and I guess you're sincere enough in the expression of it,
yeah,
it is made so.
Yes, inevitably, and it always blows my mind, despite the fact that I know that it will.
Exactly.
No.
And the point there being, you know, to bring it back around on topic, is that that's a large part of the attitude that I think is required to go outside and see legitimate UFOs that you can photograph and make movies of.
Hmm.
I'm just thinking that the mind is a very powerful thing. That
very much so. Very, very much so.
A clue how it really,
right,
really works.
Right. And there's that old saw about the fact that we only use 10% of our brain's capability. Well,
exactly.
Who decided it was 10%? I mean, it could be one or two even.
Or less.
Yeah.
Certainly not more. I don't think you could underestimate the actual capability of these computers that we have between our ears.
Mm-hmm.
But other things that he talked about that was kind of interesting as far as Mr. St. John is concerned is he mentioned the shaman and alluded to a coming concrescence, something,
yes,
that he felt was going to happen. And
mm-hmm.
before we broke up last segment, you were indicating that there was some potentiality of, well, the looming concrescence that I discussed earlier. But
yes.
I hear that we are out of time.
Yes, the looming concrescence of finality here for this Saturday night. Yeah, things are shaping up, it seems. Camps are assigning themselves, and we shall see what happens next. Thank you, Alfred Lemberg. It's always good. Good night, and thank you, Julian McNabb. Sorry we missed you, Jim Pacheco, and the folks at CJAD, but I'm sure that football, a number one. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp, the executive producer.